And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein on the Tone.
On today's show, members of James Bond's musical family remember John Barry, composer, arranger, and the man who gave 007 his soundtrack.
Sean Connery walking on the screen and lighting a cigarette isn't James Bond, in my view, unless the music's playing alongside him.
Who are you?
My name is Bond. James Bond.
Successful kick than the Bond movies. The biggest series in the history of the movie industry.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Russia with Love was a great song. That was the second. That wasn't a big hit, but it was somehow one of those songs that everybody knew. And that must have suddenly, you know, the old light bulb went, yes, hang on, a song and Goldfinger, wow.
He's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch.
Dr. No. Big from Russia with Love. Bigger. Goldfinger. Even bigger. Now, here comes the biggest Bond of all. Thunderball.
He looks at this world and wants it all. So he strikes like Thunderball.
John never thought commercially. He really didn't. I mean, he was not that kind of guy who thought commercially, you know. When it came to Bond songs, you know, he wanted them to work, but he wanted them to work for the picture mainly.
You only live twice, or so it seems. One life for yourself, and one for your dreams.
I don't think you can fault a single John Barry, James Bond score. It's just an extraordinary method for an action film. You know, for films that became known for action movies, that John very rarely wrote action music for. It kind of held an umbrella, a kind of like an extraordinarily classy umbrella over the entire scene. And that approach allowed the acting and the gadgets and the bits and pieces to kind of happen, but all the time you felt like you were being just elevated above, you know, this is not ordinary anymore because this music tells us that it's something extraordinary.
Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it. Touch it, stroke it and undress it. I can see every part. Nothing hides in the heart to hurt me.
I mean, I think Diamonds Are Forever is actually the best Bond song. And one of Don's greatest ever lyrics. I just think that it's a brilliant song.
He has a powerful weapon. He charges a million a shot. An assassin, a second to
James Bond.
Just like the Moonraker goes in search of his dream of gold, I search for love, for someone to have a hold.
Bessie always adds that drama. As I've said before, I think Shirley should sing all.
We're an all-time high. We'll change all that's gone before. Doing so much more than falling in love.
I now wish I had called that song off for Pussy, because it would have been a much better song. I mean, it was a nice song.
Right.
Lovely tune by John, but it tends to come 19th in all-time best James Bond polls, which is probably fair. If it had been called Octopussy, I'd have written a much more intriguing lyric.
Meeting you with a view to a kill, face to face in secret places, feel the chill.
The great thing about, for me, Bond films is that the music is a big part of it, but the audience actually wants to enjoy it. You know, I think they want to enjoy the films. They come back to them wanting them to be as good as their favourite one. And they're willing to come back to it every time, wishing for it to be the greatest Bond film ever. And for 15 seconds at the start, when that gun barrel comes across, you know, potentially you could be sitting in front of the greatest James Bond film ever made. The great thing about that moment was, as well as with the songs, is that for 3 minutes you've got an audience, a cinema full of people listening. You know, they're not talking, they're not doing, they're not distracted by explosions or helicopters. It's like they're listening to the music. So, I mean, as a platform for songwriters, it's a glorious opportunity.
He's tall and he's dark, and like a shark he looks for trouble. That's why the zero's double. Mr. Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang. He's suave and he's smooth, and he can soothe you like vanilla. The gentleman's a killer. Mr. Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang.
A quarter century of John Barry's James Bond theme song. Plus, one that got away that kind of sums up the whole genre, Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. John Barry died in January. He wrote for stage, screen and shampoo commercial and was amazingly successful in every field. Oddly enough, the only time I ever sat down and did a big formal interview with him was about one of his very few total failures, a Broadway adaptation of one of his favourite novels, Lolita. So we may dig out that tape and run it as a separate show, but for today we'll put his stage work to one side and we'll touch on everything else, his pop singles, his arranging, his film work. But we're going to concentrate on what he did for James Bond over the course of 25 years. And the spine of our show will be the big Bond theme songs he wrote for each of those movies. John Barry was a big part of London's swinging 60s. He was flatmate to Michael Caine, husband to Jane Birkin, co-owner of a fashionable restaurant with the Queen's cousin and groovy photographer Patrick Litchfield. I remember the first time I met him finding it odd to hear arcane points of Hollywood orchestration being explained with traces of the flat vowels of his native Yorkshire. But he belonged to the first generation of gritty northern lads to find fame in the metropolis, and unlike most of them, when the 60s stopped swinging, he survived and got better and better at what he did. He was one of the very greatest composers to emerge from that era, and a man whose harmonic and orchestral skills were rich, distinctive, and enduring, as we'll hear. When he died, I wrote a little something about him at Stein Online, and in the weeks afterwards, so many folks I ran into said to me, "Do you remember that bit in Goldfinger when, or do you remember that moment in On Her Majesty's Secret Service?" That I thought it'd be fun to hear some of the things we were talking about, and to remember John's role in 007's legend. So I've convened a trio of friends and colleagues from what Barbara Broccoli calls the Bond family, reprising their role from the Mark Stein Christmas show a couple of years ago when we touched briefly on their Bond songs. We have a brace of Oscar-winning lyricists, Don Black and Tim Rice. Tim is best known for The Lion King and Evita, but he did write a Bond theme with John Barry for Octopussy. And Don has written more Bond lyrics than anybody else, from Thunderball to The Man with the Golden Gun, Diamonds Are Forever, to The World Is Not Enough. I think he's responsible for a fifth of all James Bond theme songs. And joining them is John Barry's successor as James Bond's music man, David Arnold. David scored a lot of other movies, Independence Day, Godzilla, Shaft, Hot Fuzz, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, from the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe series. But for the last decade and a half, he's been the composer on every Bond film from Tomorrow Never Dies to A Quantum of Solace. Let's start with Don Black, because, Don, I guess you knew him better than anybody.
Yeah, but, you know, whenever I think of John, although I've written so many songs with him, it's the lunches I remember more, more than anything else. And it's a funny thing, that, but it's true. When I look back on the Bond thing, I'm sure Tim will know, when you write songs, it's somehow it's where you wrote them. It's not only the writing of it, it's the whole thing. He was always successful. He certainly looked successful from the minute I saw him. He looked great. He had a white Maserati car. He really was cool.
Yeah, he was fabulously cool. And, I mean, no disrespect, but, you know, songwriters and composers aren't always cool. I mean, often they have cool songs and cool catalogues. But he was like a cool... He could have played Bond if, like, Sean Connery had been hit by the boom in the middle of a scene. He could have been a passable... If you'd met him on the other side of the planet... claiming to be a salesman from Universal Exports, you wouldn't have been surprised, would you?
No, he was certainly there. And, you know, he had all the trappings. He had beautiful women around him, and he had the right drinks. Not shaken and stirred, but, you know, he was very, very special.
But, yes. Tim, before we talk about John's song specifically, there's something kind of slightly wacky, isn't there, in the idea of a spy... somehow having a song catalogue, because there's nothing that says when you're making a bunch of thrillers that you're gonna throw up a couple of dozen memorable pop songs out of the whole thing. And yet music is a big part of Bond, isn't it?
Yes, I suspect it was one of those things that just kind of grew. I mean, Dr. No didn't have a song, did it? It had the theme, the wonderful theme.
They had Underneath the Mango Tree.
The Mango Tree.
Oh, right, yes, of course. Yes, but that was not really...
Not really
a memorandum.
I think the iconography of it was indelibly linked with those Binder, you know, opening title sequences as well. I mean, even from the start of Dr. No, which I know that the music that went on obviously was very late because it was John's arrangement of Monty's theme, which went on very late, but it starts off and the James Bond theme kicks in. And then you've got the travelling dot and the gun barrel. I mean, it's an extraordinary amount of iconography for nothing, from a standing start, to have the James Bond theme, the gun barrel sequence, and opening title sequence, which was, you know, entirely graphic. If you think about that and Sean Connery, I mean, for these things to all kind of collide at the same time, it's quite amazing. I mean, the Man with the Golden Arm, I think, was it slightly before that? Saul Bass titles had sort of led us, I suppose, to the Binder style.
David is one of the few survivors in the transition from the Pierce Brosnan regime to the Daniel Craig regime. I think it's you and Judy Dench who were kept on. You're like the last two Hosni Mubarak cabinet ministers still in the Egyptian government. Great survivors. But there's something...
you know, I thought Casino Royale was a terrific film, but I found it very odd the way everybody, when all the critics say, "Oh, it's great, we're getting away from the tired Bond formula," because it's actually there's a lot of things about the formula that people loved, as you say, the walking in when he comes walking in with the gun barrel and all the dolly birds twirling around the guns. People loved all that stuff.
Well, I've always said that, you know, if you get 1,000 people in a room and ask them what is good and bad about Bond movies and Bond songs, they'll all have different opinions, and they'll all be wrong and they'll all be right. You know, I mean, there literally is no pleasing everyone. And for everyone who said, you know, it's getting a bit tired, we need to do this, we need to do that, you get away from it and then they miss the bits that weren't there, and can't we get this back and can't we get that back? So, I mean, I think the only way to do it is, to a certain extent, the way that Daniel Craig kind of played the role, which was like, you don't look over your shoulder that often, and just try and keep ahead of everything. And you know, for me, it's just trying to write the film that's in front of me rather than the one that's in, you know, 250 million people's heads.
You knew John longer than anyone here, Don. Mm. And how, at the time he was like you. He was around the music business. He'd played on the he'd arranged the Adam Faith singles, and but this Dr. No was really his first big movie break, wasn't it? It wasn't. I mean, this was a kind of bigger deal than what he'd been doing before.
Yes.
Was his first score not Beat Girl, the Adam Faith movie?
No, okay. I think he did one earlier for Michael Winner.
What, Naked as Nature Intended or something? That was Michael Winner's first. It was the first Michael Winner film I saw.
I thought Beat Girl was the first one.
Yeah.
I think.
Beat Girl was a 1959 low-budget teen rebel movie, a world away from martinis in the Caribbean, except for the music. Listen to those screaming trumpets. Could be on a Bond car chase.
But that was interesting because he was working with Adam Faith, who, in retrospect, one sees now as a very cool, ahead of his time pop singer. Both his records, which were arranged by John, and Adam's whole persona was unusual for those times.
But what do you want if you don't want money? What do you want if you don't want gold? Say what you want and I'll give it you, darling. Wish you wanted my love, baby. What do you want if you don't want earning?
I don't know whether you agree with this, Tim, but I think this was a critic in The Guardian or somewhere who said that the Adam Faith records that John arranged were actually the first real British pop records. You're looking a little sceptical.
Well, they were great, don't get me wrong, but I think there were... I mean, Cliff Richard made one or two records. Cliff made it just before Adam,
right,
and Move It was a pretty good British pop record.
Yeah.
I mean, it was certainly... He was right in the forefront, and one of my... things I bang on a bit about is the lack of credit given to the pre-Beatles British pop stars. Some of them were very good, notably The Shadows, Cliff Richard, Adam Faith, Billy Fury, Marty Wilde. They were talented people who were operating in a field which nobody knew much about. And John Barry, he was perhaps the coolest of the lot. You can see that now.
With the pizzicato strings?
Well, he fired away on pop singles in his own right. He was, you know, with the John Barry 7
and Jury.
Jukebox Jury theme, hit or miss. Right. Strange hits like Beat for Beatniks. Beat for Beatniks in about 1960, I think.
which was sort of Elmer Bernstein meets, you know, the Piltdown Men. It was a strange record, but it was
which is actually a good way of putting his pop style, because it was a strange mix of sort of guitar, rock, and jazz,
and a bit of Johnny Dankworth influence, I felt. And he was doing, you know, all the stuff with Adam Faith, and I think Lance Fortune, people like that. I mean, he was very much being 60s cool before the 60s really got going.
It's funny the difference a few bars of music can make in a man's life. Monty Norman had been hired to write the music for Dr. No. It was set in Jamaica, and he wrote some very agreeable Caribbean-style songs. And along the way, somebody said, well, you know, if this works out, we'll be adapting some more James Bond novels. Maybe we ought to have a theme tune. Monty Norman thought about it and fished out an old song he'd written a few years earlier for a flop musical based on V.S. Naipaul's novel, A House for Mr. Biswas. The tune went dum-diddy-dum-dum, but he still couldn't get the sound of a British agent on Her Majesty's Secret Service with a 00 license to kill. So he recommended the producers get in John Barry to make an arrangement. And so it was that Vic Flick, the marvellous guitarist with the John Barry 7, found himself getting a £6 session fee to pick up his Clifford Essex Paragon Deluxe guitar. I believe that's now at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. To pick up his guitar and turn dum-diddy-dum-dum into this. And suddenly it all fell into place. The John Barry 7 had been playing the right music, but in the wrong venue. After being a quirky bit player on the lower reaches of the hit parade, John Barry had found his perfect musical outlet. He was the sound of 007. John Barry doing Jukebox Jerry, perfectly fine, nothing wrong with it. James Bond wandering round Jamaica to the sound of lilting Caribbean melodies, likewise, nothing wrong with it. But James Bond plus John Barry, pow! James Bond is the most successful series in film history. It's been running now for pretty much half the length of time the entire movie industry has. And as a consequence, the James Bond theme is the best-known signature tune on the planet. There's been a lot of dispute about its authorship over the last half century, at least a couple of lawsuits, the most recent of which had Monty Norman and John Barry sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. A lot of composers take legal action for one reason or another, but Monty Norman went so far as to make a record in which he sings, complete with special lyrics, the story of how a number from A House for Mr. Biswas wound up in Dr. No. If you read between the lines, as it were, you'll notice that there are certain bits of the James Bond theme, the release, the brooding shark under the water passage between the dum-diddy-dum-dum and the release, a lot of bits whose provenance is not explained. But regardless of who wrote the notes, nobody spent more time with them over the decades than John Barry. Having made a brilliant arrangement of the theme, he found himself having to do it all over again in the next film, and the one after that, and the one after that. 1963, from Russia with Love, taking things a little slow.
Hey.
1964. Goldfinger, picking up the pace in it. ...1965, Thunderball, a wild orchestral version. 1967, You Only Live Twice, opening with the death of James Bond and his burial at sea. Well, what else would you play at the funeral? 1969, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, 007's Back from the Grave, Cool and Swing. But it's a new Bond. Not Sean Connery, but George Lazenby. John Barry has a new sound there, with the melody up there on a Moog synthesizer. ...1971, Diamonds Are Forever, Bond's on a hovercraft from Dover, riding across to the Netherlands. ...1974, The Man with the Golden Gun. A long way from Vic Flick's percussive guitar at breakneck speed, it's all brooding strings. 1985. View to a Kill, Roger Moore's swan song as James Bond. Sounds a bit like 007's trying to shake off the remnants of disco-era percussion. 1987, The Living Daylights. Like those symphonic strings? Just wait. Timothy Dalton takes over from Roger Moore, and for a harder 007, a harder sound. John Barry uses very prominent electronic rhythm tracks with the orchestra opener. It's a new sound, and one that proves very influential in the composers who will score Bond in the years after. 007 arrives in India to rendezvous with his MI6 contact when he chances to pass a snake charmer.
It's a charming tune. You do take English money.
Only gold sovereigns. Please. I'm Vijay, Special Expediter, Universal Exports. Welcome to India, Commander Bond.
That's the tennis player Vijay Amritraj, as Universal Exports man in Udaipur. I don't think Vijay was actually playing his own snake there, but you never know. As 007 says, it's a charming tune. I'll leave it to the lawyers to argue about who contributed what, but as John Barry himself said to me, which one of us did they ask back? Dr. No was Monty Norman's first and last Bond film. John Barry stayed for the next quarter century and defined not just James Bond, but the sound of spy music in film. This was the movie with which he took control of the series, From Russia with Love. From Russia with Love, where Bond flies to Istanbul and he checks into his hotel and he's just searching the room to see if there's a bug in the telephone or anything.
As we all do.
It's a very good idea. And you hear the Bond theme, you hear the dun-dun-dun, just as he's like checking out his hotel room. So it's not as if he's falling out of a plane or he's skiing down the Alps to parachute off with his Union Jack parachute. It's none of that. It's just... he's just walking around the hotel room.
Well, sometimes as well, they just cut that Bond theme in, that original recording. I mean, you hear it, obviously, in Doctor No, it's cut into so many scenes that perhaps you might not otherwise expect to hear it, because I think they got it and they were so thrilled with it, we thought we were just going to use it.
Right.
And to a certain extent, in Russia with Love, I think to compound the almost like the trademark aspect of it, they used that recording an awful lot as well. You know, it cut into so many different parts where you absolutely wouldn't expect it, and you think like, why is this playing at this moment? But somehow, because you know it so well, you don't question the fact that it's kind of driving you in when nothing's going on. But it says, you know, you turn the lights out, and that's pitch black, it says who he is, you know, without you seeing a single thing. That was the genius of the sound of that thing, you know.
James Bond is too big a star for merely one signature tune, so for From Russia with Love, John Barry wrote him a subsidiary tune, the 007 theme, heard in various Bond movies over the years: Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, Diamonds Are Forever, Moonraker. Now, From Russia with Love had a song, it was a Lionel Bart song, but it was still a real song. I think you hear it from a transistor radio in the park where Bond's on a rather improbable date with the lady from the previous film. But the one where the formula falls into place, I think, is Goldfinger, because that's where you have the pre-title sequence and then the song, and a real Bond song, and that's with lyrics by Leslie Bricusse and sung by Shirley Bassey, who I think can claim him to be, you know, the Bond song in the average viewer's head is probably being sung by Shirley Bassey. She has a great acclaim.
I think so. I mean, of course, that was a typical Bond song, but we didn't know it when it came out. I mean, it was the number one of one at the time.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin.
But wasn't it Tony Newley said that on Goldfinger that they were aiming for the German, you know, Mac the Knife,
Kurt Weill?
Kurt Weill kind of approach to the song. Right. And the original Tony Newley sung demo is a very kind of creepy, you know, talking about Goldfinger like he's a sort of creepy kind of guy, and very different to what John obviously came up to.
Yeah. But once we had that with huge, quite a beat as well.
But it was slightly jazz, but it was very sort of vibes and sort of slowed down and
spare,
creepy
orchestration and everything. Like it's like a nice little record.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch, such a cold finger, beckons you to enter his web of sin, but don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you fear. For a golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
And then he does, you know, because John just goes, wham, wham. That answering trumpet phrase was never written until they were actually in the recording studio as well, and he felt that there was a bit of a gap, and so he gets the trumpet sections to use the Harmon mute, and from that point on that was the sound that you make if you make a Bond song.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the mind. A cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin, but don't go in.
Michael Caine has often spoken about, you know, the times where he really was living in the same flat in Cadogan Square with John when John was trying to get the song Goldfinger from a sort of nascent stage to a completed stage, where he said he'd just be up all night bashing away at it and bashing away at it, and all that effort produces this song, which appears to be effortless when it's played, you know. I mean, so obviously there's so much thought went into it, but I think he was one of those rare raw talents.
Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his life. For a golden girl knows when he's
kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of this heart of gold. This heart is cold.
Yeah, and that, and then that thing that Shirley Bassey does, where she holds the final note for, yes, a week and a half.
This heart is cold. He loves only gold.
And Tom Jones did that again in Thunderbolt. Yeah.
So he strikes like thunder.
It was that all-encompassing imprint of sort of elegant quality that John put not only on the Bond films but obviously everything that he did, and very bold choices as well in you know, things like the Ipcress file, the kind of sounds, you know, right. Zulu was very sort of aggressive and propulsive and very unlike the Bond score. So he could move a million miles away from that, but it would still sound like John Barry. And again, you know, it felt simple, just the fact that, you know, you would have these horns and trombones just holding a chord, and it would just start, and then it would, you're there. I mean, it's an extraordinary gift.
And there is a cool about it, that Din Goldfinger after the song, when the camera sweeps down from the sky to Miami, whatever that hotel is, and where Goldfinger's playing cards. Yeah. As you say, it's very brassy. Sometimes he didn't. Yeah, a lot of, he did. Sometimes he would go a million miles away from that and it'd be all flute type stuff. Mm. His well didn't run dry.
He always seemed so effortlessly elegant as well.
Goldfinger, obviously, as you say, that was the first one. They just took the title, they made a song out of the title. Now, then you got the second one, Dom, of the proper Bond songs.
But yes, that was a big thing. But when I met John, and the reason I met him was because I had a song that did well called "Walk Away," sung by Matt Monro, and John Barry loved the song, and that's why he asked me would I have a go at Thunderball.
And you were delighted until...
Well, until Tom sang it, you mean?
No, until until you were told the title.
Oh, the title.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing I did, you know, was look it up in a dictionary, the word Thunderball, and it wasn't there. It was hard, you know, a tricky thing. Right. I mean, I used it as a code word, and John never took these things too seriously. Right. You know, as we know, we've discussed this before, Goldfinger, he's, you know, and... well, with Diamonds Are Forever, he said, you know, to Shirley, think of it as a penis, you know. And Thunderball, I said, John, it doesn't make any sense. Thunderball, he said, just do it and just make it sound, you know, sexy. And
he didn't say think of it as a testicle.
No.
Well,
tracks while other men just talk. Strikes like thunderbolt. He knows the meaning of success. His needs are more, so he gives less. And he strikes like thunderbolt.
So, but anyway, it worked. You know, I just have this theory that Shirley Bassey and Tom Jones, they're great voices and a bit of drama and all that stuff, and you don't analyse it too closely.
Thunderball, I think, is the name of the plot or something, isn't it? It's the secret plan or whatever. Yeah.
It's not a thing.
No, but it's not even a bad guy like Goldfinger. Yeah.
Goldfinger it was the title of a book, wasn't it?
Goldfinger was the title. Which was the name of the architect that Ian Fleming despised so much that he called Goldfinger.
Now you made a record of Thunderball, David, with Martin Fry
from ABC.
ABC, a big pop group in the 80s, yes. And you put a kind of drum.
I let it sort of sit slightly more in the rhythmic aspect of it because you know it's such a glorious, aggressive, you know, sort of sexual song, and I just thought, like, for a slightly different version of it, to have our version coming more from the waist downwards a little, and and so we kind of went for that.
So this is Thunderball, as you were saying, Tim.
Yes, exactly.
I remember Tony Newley saying to me one day that we made a mistake with Thunderball, in his opinion. Yeah. That he thought we should have started the song off with the word Thunderball.
Yeah, Leslie Bricker said that to me as well. Yeah. Too.
We ended the phrase, and he strikes like Thunderball.
Yeah, yeah.
But as they had Goldfinger, we should have had Thunderball.
Yeah.
that got really interesting when you get to The World Is Not Enough.
Yeah.
But it, yes. It's who was it? Somebody, when they heard Thunderball, said, "Oh, it's Thunderfinger," didn't they? Somebody said basically. But the great thing about that Tom Jones version is it's got all those little John Barry, all that little orchestral brooding in between the.
His days of asking are all gone. His fight goes on, and on, but he thinks that the fight
he strikes like thunder.
I went back, read the Ian Fleming novels not long ago, and as far as I know, there's only actually two references to music in the whole thing. In Casino Royale, Ian Fleming writes that Bond thought he looked a bit like Hoagy Carmichael. And then I think in, I think it might be Diamonds Are Forever, when he approaches Tiffany Case's apartment, she's listening to a record of Autumn Leaves.
Oh, right.
And I think that's based, I think that's the only two references to music in the Bond novels. Everything else about Bond, when people go on about the formula, all the other stuff, Moneypenny, the names Bond, James Bond, all the other stuff is there in the books. But the music is something that John more or less imposed on the thing. Yeah. I think.
But it's funny how
I never thought of that.
It's funny how the music and the songs have always existed in their most successful form outside of anything which is going on in the world of music in any, you know, in any other formats. Yeah. I mean, Goldfinger was a huge hit when the Beatles were having their huge hits, but it was nothing like it, you know. And all the way through John's songs, you know, they were always in a kind of in their own universe to a certain extent, as the Bond movies were as well. They're always you know, one step ahead of the actual world that we all lived in. I know there's one reference to the Beatles, isn't it, in one of the movies where Sean Connery says it's a bit like
that's Goldfinger. That's Goldfinger. How do you feel about that, Tim? When Sean Connery says to Jill Masterson or whatever, and he says, "Oh, that's like listening. Oh, unchilled champagne. That's like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs."
I don't remember that. That's in Goldfinger.
It's in Goldfinger. I mean, it's an odd thing, but it's about the only time where there is an actual reference to the real world. Yeah. You know, I mean, everything else is one step away from the real world, and it was a kind of peculiar thing to realise that James Bond actually lives in a world that we live in, because even though we recognise it, I think it's, you know, it has to be possible for him to not get lasered to, you know, in two, or to, you know, to have a fight in Fort Knox with a Korean guy with a hat, you know. I mean, it's like you have to believe that those things can happen, otherwise there's no drama and there's so it was a bit peculiar that it became sort of earthed for a moment in that sequence.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, actually, earthed, because it's like that bit whatever P.G. Woodhouse novel that is, where one of the characters suddenly starts talking about Artie Shaw marrying all these Hollywood actresses, and you think, wow, that's like really weird. It's like it locates it precisely. It's like too real in a way. It's and it's the same.
Yes, it's nowhere near Topley Towers. You don't want that.
By the way, before we leave Thunderball, here's a lovely example of something David mentioned earlier. For a composer of so-called action films, John Barry didn't write a lot of action music. He wrote all kinds of other stuff instead. And he had, I think, a big, even then, a big musical vocabulary, David, because he had some kind of rock and roll elements, but he had a serious jazz background. He liked Stan Kenton and all that stuff, and he liked all the big classic film composers too.
Yeah, he had a huge love for the sort of classic romantic film and also you know, classical film composers as well, but I think his love was very much in jazz, and he used to play me bits of Stan Kenton to show me where bits of things that he'd done. He goes, listen to this, Stan did this, you know, and we're doing that.
Stan Kenton's famous intermission riff. In the 50s, John Barry took a correspondence course in composition with Bill Russo, who'd
been the arranger for the Kenton Band, and when you listen back to those big Kenton hits, it's not such a stretch from Stan to Spies.
John's music sounded so elegant and so simple, but incredibly complicated ways round, you know. I mean, incredibly difficult songs to sing as well. I mean, the melodies, even though they sound so extraordinarily familiar to you when you hear them, you try singing them, it's a real stretch, because they are very sort of jazz heavy influenced.
Right.
And that kind of waned a little over the years, you know, certainly over the last sort of 20 years, 25 years, perhaps, once we get into sort of Out of Africa and Dances with Wolves and that sort of period where it became much more sort of almost pastoral. And I think probably harking back to, you know, his love of classical music as well. But the early days had that kind of, you know, that sort of bebop energy.
Yeah, the high screaming trumpets.
Yeah, and that's like sort of a real filthy guitar as well. So, you know,
he was a huge fan of Alex North. I mean, he used to talk to me for ages about Alex North.
Right.
But it's a big fan. But where did the Persuaders come in all this?
That was in 72, I think. 71, 72.
Oh, was it much later?
Yeah. Which is a really unusual. I mean, you know, you hear that theme, the Persuaders theme, which is incredibly mournful, you know, and sort of dark, and it's the campest TV show in the world. And I've often wondered why those two things came together, because it didn't seem to necessarily relate. You know, Roger Moore cocking his eye and Tony Curtis, and they're both flouncing around in a jag, you know, or on the
and floral shirts.
Yeah, I mean, it was extraordinary.
We should explain for people who haven't seen, you know, a rerun dubbed into Spanish on Channel 173 at 3 in the morning, that it featured Roger Moore as, I think, the son of an earl or something, wasn't it?
He was some sort of knob.
Yeah, and then Tony Curtis as this kind of tough guy from the streets of Brooklyn.
Mm.
And in this faintly ridiculous, as you say, floral shirts of the early 70s. But it has, as you, this, what's he got in there? Is it a harpsichord or something?
Or a cymbalum, I think, yeah, I'm not sure. Suggested that what you're about to see was far more had far more sort of gravitas and substance than perhaps it did, and it made me think, like, well, perhaps these guys have got such a sort of dark story that we do not see, that, you know, this whole thing is a charade, you know, this parade of shirts and women and double entendres, that at some point it's going to be like The Prisoner, we're going to know that something else has happened. But
The opposites in music and plot that work best. I mean, think of Pavarotti in the World Cup. Who would have thought of sticking opera, or even going right back to 2001 and Strauss, and The Third Man and Anton Karas. I mean, that was the first example to me of a great thriller spy film,
which
it was, really. With the most romantic music, you could have put into Sleepless in Seattle.
But
it worked best because it was with that vicious story about Harry Lime.
And John Barry liked that film too, and he certainly loved The Zither.
Thank you. not James Bond, but another British agent, Harry Palmer, played by Michael Caine in The Ipcress File.
The 60s wasn't a great time for harmonically sophisticated composers. I mean, there were good. You and I have argued about this, but yeah, Burt Bacharach, and you've worked with Burt Bacharach, Tim. I mean, they're really the two, aren't they? The two composers as composers to emerge from that era.
John and Burt.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I think that's very true. I mean, the 60s. I mean, great, great songs, but so many of them came from the Bob Dylan school or the Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Beatles school. But Burt Bacharach, yes, he and John were very much the exceptions that proved the rule in that decade. And they were both, I mean, they're both still effortlessly cool today. I mean, their music is still works and straddles the eras better than a lot of the other 60s stuff, perhaps.
Yeah. No,
it was unusual, but as a sort of punter in the 60s, as a teenager for a great chunk of it, I didn't think of Burt Bacharach and John Barry at the time as being anything other than part of the whole wonderful mélange.
Right.
Looking back on it now, you think, well, actually they were different.
Yeah.
They were very contemporary, but they were operating really under the rules of, you know, Gershwin and Cole Porter and all that lot, much more than Mick Jagger or Keith Richards or Bob Dylan were.
Cubby Broccoli, the great producer of the Long Series, was a pal of Frank Sinatra's, and he asked Nancy in to do the theme for the fifth James Bond film, You Only Live Twice, music by John Barry, lyric by Leslie Bricusse. 2 years later, 1969, Sean Connery declined to climb into the Tux, and so for a new 007, George Lazenby, it was decided to open not with a song, but an instrumental theme. Here's John's title piece, but as we'll hear in a moment, there was a song in the film, and a very memorable one. James Bond, movie number 6, on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Now, what about We Have All the Time in the World, David? Because that's in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And again, I remember this one...
Hal David.
That he wrote with Hal David. Louis Armstrong sang it, and I think just for that reason, John was quite fond of it.
Well, and I think it was the last thing that Louis Armstrong ever recorded, and I think he was dead within sort of 3 or 4 weeks of recording it as well. And John always spoke so affectionately about that recording session, because I think Louis Armstrong was a huge influence on him. Obviously, he appreciated his, you know, the creativity of the man, but the style as well, and the trumpet playing, which of course where John started with playing trumpet. And it was one of those. It was a funny thing, because it's the only time in a Bond movie we've had a montage, I think, you know, right. A song in the movie rather than an opening title sequence. I don't think it's ever happened before, and it hasn't happened since, where the film stops and sits fairly and squarely on the shoulders of this song.
We have all the time in the world. Time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more.
For 3 minutes. The film is carried by the song. There's very, very little sound. And of course, it was, you know, extremely poignant moment, the only time that James Bond meets someone who he actually genuinely falls in love with and ends up marrying, and of course, subsequently losing. So the sort of piquancy of that was extremely affecting. And the fact that you were allowed to enjoy it.
Every step of the way find us with the gifts of the world far behind us. Yes, we have all the time in the world just for love, nothing more, nothing less. Only love.
One of the most unusual John Barry songs for 007, Mr. and Mrs. James Bond didn't have all the time in the world, and nor did Louis Armstrong. That's a Bond moment that brought it all full circle for John Barry. When he was growing up in Yorkshire, his dad ran a chain of movie theatres. That was how John fell in love with the movies. And one day when he was a kid, Louis Armstrong came to York to make an appearance in his dad's theatre. That's where we'll leave it for part one. Dr. No from Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, On Her Majesty's Secret Service. We'll pick up the second half of John Barry's Bond years with Diamonds Are Forever. We'll hear more from Don Black, Tim Rice and David Arnold. And I may take a whack at a Bond song myself. All that coming up in part two of our celebration of John Barry's Bond music. Grab yourself a martini, shaken, not stirred, and we'll see you in a moment.